All right, welcome to the Allers. I'm Tyler here with Mark. We're doing a special over under pod today because if you didn't know this about Mark and myself, we're gamblers. And I would say that if you're a savvy coach, you are also a gambler. Now, if you say, that's not true, I'm not a gambler, I would say every decision you make is a gamble. You're making a bet on a certain course of action that you think is going to be more or less advantageous for you. I think that a savvy coach is a gambler because we actually do think in bets. We recognize that there are no absolutes. Nothing is always good or always bad. It's like this is most likely to happen most often. And we also, in thinking in bets, being a gambler, we don't result. If, you know, we go all in on pocket aces and lose, we're not going to be like, I hate that hand. No, we want that hand every single time. We want to go all in every single time, even if we lose. And so that's what it means to be a savvy coach or a savvy gambler. The opposite of a savvy gambler, Mark, what's the opposite of a savvy gambler?
Somebody that would result or
someone that doesn't double 11 on a face card because you're afraid of losing. That is not a savvy gambler.
That's right. Or yes, or always by feeling, right? So I would say a person that's not a savvy coach or not a gambler would be would make their decisions based off emotion, not values or beliefs.
The last three times I hit 16, I lost, so I'm not going to hit 16 this time. And then you mess it up for the entire table. They shun you, and you never get to play with your friends again.
Yeah, we had a split, and then another split, and then we doubled both of those, and we've got, you know, hundreds of dollars on the table, and then somebody in third base is like, I don't think they have a face card under there, so I'm going to stay on my 16.
And if you need a glossary for some of the gambling words that Mark just used, just come to our Savvy Coaches Retreat in Las Vegas this fall, and Mark will do a special breakout for you all. All right, this is good. So over-under. So typically when sports betting, which I'm not a big sports bettor, but I have dabbled. In sports betting, one of the bets you can make is over-under a total amount of points. Do you think that both teams or a single team or a single player will score over or under a certain amount of points? And that number that is the line is very often the line that will generate the most action. It's very likely to be quite close to that line. And so we're doing a special over under pod, and this is an over under on coaching. Do most coaches overuse this thing, or is it underused? Do they overcoach this thing, or is it undertaught? We're going over under, and as always, the value is in the conversation. So Mark and I are going to popcorn back and forth. We are going to identify things that maybe are overtaught or undertaught in coaching and make our argument for why we would take the over or under. Please chime in the comments. Please do, as always, like, subscribe, and share this podcast out there. And I would like to know any disagreements or agreements you have with these over-under bets. Mark, are you making the first over-under line?
Yeah, I'll go first. Okay. We started this conversation off camera before we hit record, and then we immediately stopped it and said, no, let's save it for the podcast. So we'll see where this one goes. I'm going to say, I'll throw this one to you, Tyler. Loose ball recovery, overtaught or undertaught in basketball? Wow.
I'm going to say loose ball recovery is overtaught amongst basketball coaches. And here's how I'm interpreting it. Very often, I've seen these drills go viral where coaches like doing it as a toughness drill. Get on the floor for a loose ball. You don't want it enough. And they're rolling balls out and people are diving. I'm getting like images of Shaka Smart right here, demonstrating for his team, like take a charge, get a loose ball. And everybody's like getting super hyped up. And I'm sitting in the background scoffing for three reasons. And this is why I think that loose ball recovery is overtaught. As I'm interpreting it, here's three reasons why I think it's overtaught. One, I actually don't think you should teach your players to dive on the floor for loose basketballs. When diving on the floor for loose basketballs, you're drastically increasing your risk of injury. Second, when diving on the floor for loose basketballs, you put yourself in the least advantageous position to do something with that basketball. Passes are often stolen. You're often going to get tied up. Like, there's not a lot of like next plays that you can make. Last, I actually think it's way faster to sprint to the ball and grab it up. So those are three reasons why I don't like diving on the floor for loose basketballs. And I think that it's kind of like overdone as a toughness drill. Whereas I don't think toughness is diving on the floor for loose basketballs. I think toughness is like showing up early every day. I think there's many other indications of toughness other than one moment when everyone's gathered around you screaming and yelling. Anybody's going to dive on the floor for a loose ball at that moment. But are you getting up at 6 a.m. and getting your shots up alone? I think that's toughness.
As always, context matters. I don't disagree with the loose ball drills, but I would disagree with there are times where we should dive on the floor for a loose ball. It's if it's in close proximity, like get on the floor, get the ball. Like football analogy or comparison would be scoop and score. You know, like sometimes if there's traffic, just dive on the ball. If you're by yourself, scoop it and score it. But I'm going to go under. And I'm going to go under because...
Mark, before you do, let me just say, okay. Like, I don't disagree that there are times for my teammates to dive on the floor.
And then throw it to me so I get to shoot, yeah. Yeah, so I can pull up in transition, shoot a 3-1-1-0. I'm going to go under, though, because as I watch basketball, and particularly on the weekends watching my daughter's team, AAU team, play right now, so many loose balls are tried. They're dribbled to themselves, or you know, they're just like not aggressively gone after with two hands. Yet every coach in the gym is yelling, "Grab the ball or get the ball." It's like, well, it's apparent that that is not a standard, or that has not been ingrained in your players. So I'm going to say the value of wanting to get loose balls, diving on the floor, is probably overtaught. But actually, teaching your players or repping it or going over it in a game is, or in practice, is undertaught, especially how many times you've watched a lot and coached a lot of youth basketball lately. How many times does somebody save the ball underneath their own basket?
And it's a favorite of ours.
And the coach is going to freak out, but it's like, well, have you touched on that yet? Have you gone over that yet? So I'm going undertaught on that one.
Yeah. Okay. I don't disagree with anything you said, and let's not belabor the point, but we'll have to see what the people say on who actually won this one. Because as always, the line will move with the activity. So are you over or under on grabbing loose basketballs? All right. This is timely because we talked about this on our live training last night. Great attendance from our savvy coaching members on our live training as we're deep diving into how to help your team be a better scoring team. We went deep into protection plans last night. And a lot of really good stuff connecting our protection plans to trigger certain actions. Our coaches got a lot out of it. If you are not yet a Savvy member, come give us a try. Head to SavvyCoach.com. I think you'll get a ton out of it, including film breakdown for our annual members, which I have a couple in my inbox today. Last night, we talked a lot about teaching effort, demanding effort. So that's top of mind this morning. Mark, overtaught or undertaught? Playing hard, giving effort.
This was number one on my list. So it was top of mind this morning for me. I had playing hard. So I'm going to go under. And actually, again, it was top of mind. I had every Thursday morning when we record, I have a consulting call with a college coach. And we're just talking about like, how can we win some margins here? He's going to be undersized in his team. Not going to have a lot of rim protection. So he was like, man, we just got to win at the margins. And the first thing, again, top of mind is, can we just play harder? Like, can we just spend all of our time early in the season setting the standard how hard we play? That is undertaught in basketball. I even made this reference last night. It's happened to me. I'm not above this. It's not beyond me. But oftentimes it's the first game, your first contest against somebody else, and you're like, oh, no. We don't play near hard enough. And I think that is a good indicator of how you train and practice. If it takes you to your first game to realize you don't play hard enough, you're probably doing a lot of drills in practice instead of games and competing.
That's just a great reminder and indicator. Every season, there's a moment where you realize I haven't taught my team to play hard enough. So just like script it, plan it in. Is there a way to do that? I think that'd be very, very powerful. I am going to take the under as well, and I have nothing additional to add. It is the shortest path to improvement. Get your team to play harder. And it's not easy. It's not easy. I would say you and I would find many challenges to getting your teams to play harder. But just because it's hard, remember the A in savvy stands for adversity. We believe that adversity strengthens. Because it's hard, it is valuable. Not because it's hard, we should shy away from it and try to find something easier. If it's hard, it's valuable. So run towards the adversity. Okay, I'll give you one. No, it's your turn to give me one, right?
Yeah, I'll give you one here.
We agreed on that one. We both went under.
We did. All right, this is going to be, this could be undertaught or over undertaught or over under spend enough time one. Post defense.
All right, overtaught. I believe that there's too much time spent on post defense. And I'll just make this very simple argument. It doesn't happen very often in games. Like, it's not very often that you're actually defending someone who catches the ball in the post. And it's not very often you play against a team or a player that whose primary weapon is a post player. So I think that is overtaught. I know, I'm even thinking back to my college coaching career when I was an assistant coach. It was a part of, we did shell every day when I was a college assistant. We did defensive shell every single day.
Was and that a lot of fun as a player?
I mean it was the player's favorite part of practice.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we did shell every day, and a part of shell every day was post defense box drill, where you had to like dance around the offensive player that was stationary, like making a box around him, like step through, sit on him, get the high side, low side, underneath, a defensive box drill every single day. So I'm saying it is overtaught. It is overcooked.
Man, I was on the fence. This is why I asked this, because it could go either way. You almost convinced me of over. My initial reaction was under, because again, like, there's two ways to find out you have a leaky roof. You get it inspected or you wait till it rains. And I find most coaches will wait till it rains to realize, like, oh no, we haven't even talked about post defense yet. And we're about to play this 6'4 girl or this 6'8 dude. And how should we defend them? Right. Or, we just got destroyed in the post last night. So kind of like a playing hard thing is you get exposed there. So I think it's often forgot about, but maybe rightfully so, because it doesn't happen enough. I'll share this text message I got from my good friend. If you're listening to the podcast, you probably know him. He's a friend of ours, actually, a friend of Tyler's too, Doug Novak. He texted me, this was on Monday, I think, and he said, he sent me some low post concepts, and he just said post play stuff and sent me some videos. And I said, great stuff. Thanks for the share. And his response was, low post play is not a popular topic these days. So if it doesn't happen a lot, we probably should spend less time on it. So I'm kind of torn on that. I'm going to, if I was betting, I would probably pass on this one or hedge my bet. But I'm going to stick with my initial reaction. I'll disagree with you. I will say under, because I think it's often forgot about when installing defense.
Well, I haven't yet heard a defensive question that has not been answered in the Lock Left defensive system. You want some free Lock Left resources, go to lockleft.com. You can get some free resources. We just actually redid our free resources this week. And so per this question, we just simplify our post defense in the Lock Left so we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, so that we do address it. It's full front all the time with our post defense. That's it. Like, we just don't want the ball to go there. If the ball does somehow get in there over our full front, they're going to catch it and shoot it, hopefully with a weak side contest, and the possession's over. We don't have to actually try to guard in the post or determine how are we going to help in the post or determine, like, are we going to sit top shoulder, low shoulder? You know, where's the double coming from? Are we going to double? Are we digging? No, we just don't want to spend time on all that stuff. Let's just simplify it and say, let's keep the ball from going there at all.
Yeah, I'd argue do that with everything. Yeah.
All right,
your turn.
Okay, over under, passing.
Gosh, this one is so much like post defense for me. I could take this both ways. I'm going to say over, but here's why. I think we as basketball coaches, I'll include myself in here, too many block passing drills. I went and saw a Division I practice this past season, and they spread out, they partnered up, and they did 2-on-0 passing. I used to do that as well. I would never do that now, because there is no context. If we're not training in context, then it has little to no value. And here's how I know that. Here's how it was illustrated in that practice. They did 2-on-0, and then they're Division One, so they high major, so they have, you know, 19 managers, and they went in and they played defense, like 2-on-1, player in the middle drill, and they turned the ball over a bunch. So it's like, well, why did we just wasted 5 minutes of 2-on-0? Let's do that extra 5 minutes on passing. So I'll say overtaught would be block passing drills.
I am going to say undertaught. Passing is undertaught, the opposite of what you said. Please chime in the comments, in the chat. Send us an email. You know, hit us up on any anywhere you do your social media, and just chime in. Is passing over or undertaught? As always, how you define passing really matters, as Mark defined it. With block training, it's overutilized. One thing that I think we here at Savvy is like, we're not big fans of three-man weave either, which would be another common way that coaches would say, oh, we need to improve our passing. Passing and catching on the move, three-man weave. I've often argued, well, I've never seen a team three-man weave up the floor either.
Maybe the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yes.
I will say this, though. Sorry to interrupt. I will say undertaught passing and catching on the run.
Agreed.
Sidebar, but go ahead. Keep going.
Well, that's not a sidebar. That's actually my point. So okay. Undertaught, passing and catching on the run, is, I think, is undertaught. I would say three things that are undertaught in passing. Passing and catching on the run, specifically bombs, what we call bombs at Savvy, which are hit-ahead passes to a catch and a finish at full speed. That pinpoint pass and then the ability to catch and finish without taking a dribble with a trailing defender. I mean, those shots are missed so much. They should be nines and are not made 90% of the time. So that would be one. Second, like clicks. So like 0.5 decisions to move it. We've gone through this on our player development course, which we're deep diving right now. It is undertaught the ability to just click the basketball. It's what most catches should result in if you're playing a conceptual race and space, drive and space offense, should be clicks. So the read to move it within 0.5 is undertaught. The ball sticks too much. And then the last one would be passing to shooters with pinpoint accuracy. Passing accuracy leads to shooting accuracy. When we recognize as a ball handler, when we recognize that we've generated a 7 or an open off the catch 3, an extra split second to make sure that the ball hits the shooter in their hands. Like, you think about the great passers. I mean, LeBron's talked about this a lot. Like, he knows where his teammates, different shooters throughout his career, like the ball. Do they like a little low? Do they like a little high? Do they like on the right side, the left side? You know, the great passers always give shooters seams when they're making the pass, even in the midst of gameplay. It's like all of that accuracy. We all know as a shooter that when you have to reach for the ball or it's outside of your strike zone, it takes you longer to get the ball into your, what we call a load position to shoot it, and you don't shoot as accurately. So I think that is underutilized. I remember I went in and did a quick little practice piece for St. Mary's. Years ago, I went and did an audit for St. Mary's. Head coach is like, hey, what do you notice about our practice? And what's one we could work on? Just gave me like 15 minutes of practice. And what I noticed was like a lack of intention on their passes, and like passes were flying all over the place. And so we actually just did like an intent passing accuracy game for shooting reps. And they had never even considered that before. So I would say that is undertaught.
Yeah. Another value in passing the ball, obviously better pass, better shot percentage. You lose advantage when you pass off time, off target. A lot of times we get into dominoes, so we have an advantage. I kick to that corner player and they look like a soccer goalie, is a common term that we use, right? You don't want your receivers looking like a soccer goalie. But when they do that, that second that it takes for them to reach for the ball, then bring it in, you lose advantage. Now we're neutral and we got to start all over. All right, here's the next one for you. Technique.
Oh, man, that's tough.
This is a tough one.
All right, I'm just going to go in its simplest interpretation. Technique is overtaught. Technique is overtaught. Shooting technique, overtaught. Finishing technique, finishing moves, overtaught. Footwork, overtaught. Yeah, it's all overtaught. It's overtaught because it's overtaught in the interpretation that there is a right and a wrong. One of my academy coaches, it's amazing. My academy coaches spend so much time with me, and they continue to say so many traditional basketball things that I'm so against. And every time they do, I'm like, ah, do you even care? I walked in one of my academy coaches doing a one-on-one individual. And afterwards, you know, the coach is talking with me, and the coach is like, yeah, we just got to keep working on this player's technique, their shooting form, their shooting technique. I'm like, have you not listened?
Who are you? Time?
Who are you? Anyway, function over form. So I think technique is overtaught. And please make the argument the opposite way.
I can't. I can't. Yeah, I was going over. I kind of made a list in preparing under over, and that's in my over. I just think, again, it goes back to the same rationale that you said in the passing. It's done out of context, or it's too strict. It's too rigid. Reads first, technique second. Technique has a place. I think technique just shortens the path to mastery. So can we get them doing the right thing? So playing, okay, we open this one by talking about effort and playing hard. I used this example last night in our live training with our members. Ball screen coverage. We could have this like great technique of how we get into the offensive player's hip and my footwork to get over the screen, and Tyler's footwork on how he's going to hard hedge and two hard slides with his hand out. But if we're not doing it hard enough, who cares? Like, we're going to get beat anyway, and we're going to get frustrated. So I'm going to say over. Come at us in the comments if you disagree. All right.
I'm going to give you what may be a softball. Let's see if anything good comes out of it. Plays. Oh, are you taking the over or the under on plays?
I mean, I had this one as over. Actions over plays. I think when you run plays, you do it to create a shot. And oftentimes that's not a shot that you want. It's, we came off floppy and we got this stagger and we got the shot that we tried to create off of it, but it might not be a big advantage shot. It might not be a seven that you're trying to get. So I would rather 2 to 3 player actions that create advantage, get us in the dominoes, all the things that we talk about all the time. I think you're going to go the other way on me. I think this was a trick question, but yeah, I'll kick it to you here. Plays.
I am going to go the other way, but it wasn't a trick question. I was going to go the other way no matter what way you went.
Because it can be interpreted either way.
Exactly. So, all right, first let me support Mark's over. Most coaches have too many of them. Most coaches spend too much time on them. And most coaches run the same plays that they've been running for as long as they've been coaching because they're too comfortable with them. So that's the case for the over, and a very, very strong case. I'm going to take the under, because regardless of if you do those three things or if a coach does those three things, they still don't teach the play well enough. It's undertaught. For example, I was speaking with one of our academy players, senior, and talking about how their high school coach has 21 plays, and this player constantly gets yelled at when they don't run the play correctly. And so they've lost the trust of this coach because they don't run the play correctly. But this player is actually pretty smart. She's like, the reason you run a play is to get an advantage. And she's like, in the midst of the play, if they take away what we're trying to do, I just read that and I go do this other thing and I get yelled at. Right. And so I'm actually going to say that coach has undertaught that play or the play because they haven't taught the why of the play. They haven't taught the counter to the play because he still wants them to do option A when option A is being taken away. He hasn't taught them what option B is or what the counter is. So I'd say in teaching a play, there's nothing wrong with running plays. What's wrong is not teaching the why and not providing your players the tools to make reads when the play creates the advantage that you want. You know, at the end of a game, when you must score, you probably should have an after timeout or dead ball play to create the advantage for your primary defender. There's nothing wrong with having plays, but I would say plays when utilized are undertaught.
Yeah. Okay. Of all the lock left film breakdowns that you've done, how often does defense do what they're supposed to do as far as in position, move us according to the lock left principles? What percentage of the time do they do that 100% in a single possession?
Yeah. I would say 1%. do they do exactly what they're supposed to do?
I would agree. How many times do we watch film of our own teams and we're like, oh, you should be two steps over here. You should have had, you know, this angle here. Well, when we design plays, we do it with defense, like exactly in mind, right? This defender is going to be here. So we screen here. Well, defense is not going to be there. So I would say, I would agree. Again, context matters. Undertaught is maybe counters or adaptability within the plays.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting is that's one of the reasons why there's two reasons. There's two reasons why plays work better at higher levels of competition and work worse at lower levels of competition. There's the obvious one and the one that you probably haven't thought about. The obvious reason why plays work better at higher levels is because you have better offensive players to execute better. They can understand and execute very, very quickly. Okay. Here's the one that is not very obvious why plays work better at higher levels. At higher levels, the defense is more often where they're supposed to be. At lower levels, defense is less often where it's supposed to be. Like, I'm even thinking like at the youth level right now, which both of us are involved in, you want to go run a high ball screen. Half the time, no one's guarding the ball. It's a screen. Or half the time, there's three people guarding the ball. And so why are you running the ball? You know what I mean? It's like the defensive variance is so high at lower levels.
Yeah, I'll say this, and this is, we both love a ghost screen. I think we would agree on that. Here is the problem with ghost screens at the lowest levels is defense does not diagnose the screen fast enough. So you can't, they're just like, hey, I'm following this player and I don't know what just happened, but they're over here now, so I'm just going to stay with them, right? It doesn't cause confusion. At the highest levels, they diagnose everything so fast, so you can take advantage of them doing that.
We had a scrimmage last night with our high school girls, and this is club. Most of the players on the floor will be college basketball players, and we were running ghost as our default rose series action and getting nothing out of it because the defense had no plan for how they were guarding a ball screen.
Right.
And so there was no hedge to take advantage of. Because there was no hedge. We should have just kept driving in a straight line. So that's the problem with play.
Okay. Maybe this is a tough one. Blocking out. I can tell by
which
the pause.
Way am I going block. With this one? These are good. Over-unders are good. I mean, this would be a fun exercise for your staff. If you were to write down the 8 things, or pick a number, less than 10, the 8 things that you care most about as a head coach in your program, and then go to your staff and say, hey, take the over and under on this. And why? Last season, right? Did we over teach or under teach? Did we, spend too much time or not enough time and focus on this? And tell us why. I mean, your staff would be much more aligned coming out of an exercise like that, as opposed to here's our handbook and here's our, culture standards. This do these exercises are where the learning takes place. We talked about this. Don't worry. I hope to get back to it. You might have to ask me again. We talked about this on our live training last night as well. Telling your team or telling a player the read or when they should use a protection plan in and of itself doesn't have value. The value comes when your team or an individual player or players on your team have done it so much that they can't mess it up under the pressure of competition. And you stopping and telling them again what they should have done has very little value. The autopsy of seeing that they aren't making the right read means they need to be put in that situation more often until it becomes automatic. And I think the same goes for, as I connect this back to doing exercises like this with your coaching staff, right? You verbalizing to your coaching staff how you want to guard ball screens is not as valuable as your coaching staff doing exercises or activities on the floor or teaching your players how you want to guard ball screens. Be about it, don't talk about it. So all that being said, I'm taking the under. It is under taught. Now, I won't even frame boxing out for the people here and all the problems I have with boxing out. I actually don't teach boxing out. I don't think there's any value in boxing out. I think there's value in rebounding. Boxing out is just one way that one might rebound. There's value in scoring. There's lots of ways to score, but scoring is the outcome. Rebounding is the outcome. And I think rebounding, I guess I'm reinterpreting your question. I think rebounding is under taught. I think there's three games. There's the O game, the D game, and the rebounding game. Too often, coaches, we approach our practice planning, our time, and our teaching two games, right? Offense and defense. So if we're looking at like the total amount of time, most coaches might throw in a rebounding drill at less than 33% of their overall focus. Now, we at Savvy believe that you're not just working on offense, you're not just working on defense, you're working on both sides of the ball at the same time. I think that equal in the third leg of, you know, teaching all sides of the ball is to emphasize rebounding in all that you do. If we're working on offense at all times, we're working on defense at all times, and we're working on rebounding at all times. And very few coaches are doing that with emphasis and measurement and standards at all times. And that's why I take the under.
Yeah. It's funny you went to rebounding. I had rebounding, and right under it, I had blocking out. And I couldn't determine which one I was going to ask, because I was going to say rebounding would be under for all the reasons that you said. I mean, let's say a high school game, if you're running race and space, is like 65 possessions. Let's say we turn it over 15 times, probably too much, but let's just be conservative here. So we're getting 50-ish shots. Our opponent's getting around the same amount of shots, hopefully less, but that's 100 times a game that rebounding comes into play. Even on made baskets, there's still rebounding involved, right? Because great offensive rebounders go on the rise of the shot. Great defensive rebounders will, here he goes blocking out, will check the player that they're guarding to see if they're pursuing the ball. If they're not pursuing the ball, then I don't have to block out. So I was going to say overtaught blocking out. I think oftentimes if we get out rebounded, a general approach is, or a general thought would be, oh, we didn't block out enough. But there's probably a more specific reason why you didn't. Maybe you did block out, but you weren't physical enough. Maybe you did block out, but you went too late. And maybe you did block out, and the other player is just bigger, stronger, faster, and the ball bounced a little bit more their way, and there's nothing you can do about it. So overtaught, I'd go blocking out. Undertaught, I would definitely say rebounding. Rebounding is kind of one of those things that, like post defense, I said, is it's like, oh man, we haven't spent a whole lot of time on rebounding, and we play a game next week, or we get exposed with a leaky roof, and then we gotta pour it on and do a bunch of rebounding stuff. If that's you, a 10-minute rebounding drill is not going to make the difference, right? You got to bake it in everything that you do.
Let me just go through a 3-point checklist on rebounding. And I want to acknowledge right now, like, I feel like that's where, you know, if my test as a head coach is our club teams, that's probably where I have missed the boat the most, been the weakest. Like, if someone watched our teams play, our teams do not stand out as good rebounding teams. I would say that's probably the biggest weakness. And I'm committed to changing that. But here's the three steps that I would encourage a coach working through to become a better rebounding team. Step one, chase the ball. Can all players at all times give effort to pursue the basketball? That's checklist number one. Like, just freeze frame on film, right? Whatever your scheme is on the offense or defensive, you know, glass, how many, whatever, can they all just go and pursue the basketball? You're going to be a better rebounding team. And like, all right, step two, second effort. Okay. So a second effort would be after, if you're pursuing the ball and your opponent, your adversary is pursuing the ball, most often, let's talk about your team, most often a player will give one effort, run into the adversary in some sort of contact or positional advantage or disadvantage. And most often, that contact stops the pursuit. It stops the effort. So then can they just make some sort of second effort? I mean, there's so many techniques there. Swim, spin, wedge, whatever. There's so many second efforts, right? But most players don't give the second effort. Just give a second effort. One, pursue, first effort. Two, give second effort, right? Okay, then the third thing would be, and it's language we use, Savvy, instead of boxing out, then it would be erasing. Okay, can we identify who, when, and how we actually want to erase the adversary from the rebounding equation? The rebounding equation is who has more bodies within 5 feet of the ball. That's the equation. So how can we erase one of the opponent's bodies from the equation? You know, traditionally, the only technique taught is boxing out, and all players should box out. And I think it's just backwards in that three-step process. if you just autopsied or, you know, did a black light on possessions through film or direct feedback or at the end of a game or a quarter, and just like, let's get to level one, all pursue, level two, all give second effort, level three, identify and execute erasing strategically. Maybe that's, you have one eraser that's always erasing. Maybe there's one opponent on the other end that you want to erase. Maybe you got some other level of your rebounding mathematics. That's all in role rebounding in the lock left defense is helping you think through that rebounding equation. So maybe that helps, makes it actionable for you. All right, I'm gonna go with a wild card here. Okay, I'll do this one. Body language.
Oh, easy. Under for me.
Go ahead. I love it.
You're going over. I have a feeling. Yeah, yeah. Oh man, this is the most we've disagreed on the podcast, but it's been good. This has been really fun.
That's the value of over under.
Yeah. And a lot of it is like agree to disagree or agree, but I also disagree on this. And it's what we do every day with our savvy coaches is like, can we help you shape your lens and be able to coach with clarity in this? Because context does matter. And we always joke that we could answer every question with "it depends." And that is true. But I do think coaching with clarity and with confidence is being able to take a stance on these things and just having a clear reason why, whether Tyler agrees or disagree, or whether you listening at home agree or disagree. Okay. Body language. I'm just going to say under because I would say most coaches don't spend any time on it. I mean, I would say body language would be a great place to start if you're looking, you know, we're recording this mid-May right now. If you're going into your summer season in high school or college, you're getting your transfer kids or your high school players on campus for the first time, I would establish standards around body language. And here's how I would do that. In a team, your first team meeting, I think it's important to cast your vision on who you want your team to be, but also for them to do the same as players. And like, what team do we want to be? What, we're all going to spend a lot of time together. We're going to sacrifice. We're going to put a lot of effort into this. What do we want to get out of it? What do we want the end product to look like? I would just have them group up, write down three characteristics, body language characteristics of a championship team and three characteristics of a losing team. And just very clearly define that. And now you have your above the line body language and your below the line body language. The players will come up with that standard. All you have to do as a coach is hold them accountable, give them reminders, give them support on them being the team that they want to be. So easy one for me, undertaught.
Agreed.
I thought you were going over.
I am.
Oh, agreed, but over. Got it.
I agree with everything you said. I think that it is over emphasized by most coaches because of how much it frustrates coaches when their players do have poor body language or what a head coach might interpret as poor body language. Here is where I think that we as coaches give too much emotional energy to our players' body language, and it causes us to become emotionally unstable because of how frustrated we get with the player because of their body language. So I think we overemphasize it. Many people in the world come from a very different upbringing and experience than we do. In that, like, there are cultures on this globe that actually providing direct eye contact is a sign of challenge and disrespect. I've had the cool opportunity to teach basketball all across the world. And what I got to run camps in Japan. And I was teaching this group of 120 Japanese teenagers. And like it was a classroom session and I'm like lecturing, they're taking notes and no one would look at me. And I'm like, give me eye contact. And there's an interpreter there, right? And the interpreter like stopped and said, hey, he's like, actually, like all of their teachers, they're very high, it was a high academic international school. It's like all of their teachers actually don't want them to give eye contact because it's a sign of challenge. They want them to like kind of like submit to their authority. He's like, so like they've been asked not to give eye contact their entire lives. And I'm there yelling at them to give eye contact, right? I didn't have that context. My interpretation of what respectful body language was the exact opposite of their interpretation of body language. Another one, there I was working with a player a number of years ago, and I went to just like encourage this young man and put my hand on his shoulder. And every time I went to do that, he would flinch away from me, right? And I'd be like, don't flinch away from me, like stand here. And then like, I got to know him longer, and like, I got to know, like, he came from an abusive background. So, like every time, like an older man would like get around him, it just like brought up like physical abuse for him. Right. And I'm like, no, show me respectful body language, stand still, you know, like, and so I just think that sometimes I would take the over just because we think that our interpretation of what good body language is, we just slap on to every situation without understanding context, and it can trigger us without us really understanding what's going on. I mean, those are extreme examples, but like a less extreme example is just like when someone is like very disappointed in themselves, you know what I mean? And they, like I've watched Steph Curry. I think we've all seen this. When Steph Curry's having a really bad shooting game,
his body language is terrible,
right? He puts the towel over his head on the bench and just goes into his own place. If we just like turned on the television and got that freeze frame without context, we're like, what bad body language, what a terrible leader, right? But if we like understood the course of his career and like fast forward to how he's going to come back in the fourth quarter, like how he's able to bounce back from terrible performances, I'd say his bounce back ability is all time. I mean, even going back to Davidson, I think you even talk about Coach McKillips when he recruited him, he saw Steph Curry have like a 10 turnover first quarter and like bounce back and like win the game. He's like, I can trust that kid. And that's what allowed him to trust him at Davidson. When he would, you know, go 0 for 15, he would tell him to keep shooting, right? So his body language in that moment is actually how he bounces back. But if we just say, oh, that's bad body language, I'm going to bench him, you're not going to get the bounce back. So I just think context matters, and that's why I'm taking the over. I think coaches have like an overvaluing of what they think is a great body language without context. I know I talked a lot about that, but it's a hot topic, I think.
Yeah, I would say I've been guilty of that too. Here's the body language I can't get over is when somebody walks into the gym with bad body language. Then I'm just like, oh, like, you don't want to be here, you know, like, come on, man, like walk in, like, let's go. Like we're here to work. We're here to have fun.
Yeah.
But I do think also coaches do overreact to players showing emotion, like showing emotion, even negatively, is like, hey, I care. Like that's why Steph Curry is doing that. He cares, but don't be emotional. Like, you know, don't let's try to avoid a negative play on offense leading to a negative play on defense. And your ability to bounce back is important. I think as you coach your players, you develop that level of trust. I'm just thinking of a lot of the players that I've coached is like, I didn't really care if they had bad body language, 'cause I know they were going to give really great effort on the next play. It was their way of getting over it and playing with emotion.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think that's like a great example of understanding context as well. And so, yeah, I agree with you. And I think that coaches could embrace a little bit more of that nuance.
Agreed. Okay. Let's go one more. We're almost at time here, so we'll go rapid fire as much as we can, but I'm looking at this one. I don't know. Transition defense.
Under.
Yeah. It's the, I was going to say under too, as in my
mind. We agree. We ended on agreement.
We end on it. It's the hardest part of defense, right? Your opponent's points per possession are always going to be the highest there. Spend more time on it. If you can eliminate your opponent's transition points, save you 4 to 5, 6 points a game, it could be the difference in your season.
Yeah. All right. How? Real quick, how? And we address this in the lock left defense as well, right? Ball wall danger. Get someone on the ball faster. This is non-traditional. I share a study in the lock left course about defensive proximity to the ball and its effect on points per possession transition. The closer that you get a defender to proximity on the ball earlier, the lower the points per possession in transition. The further a defender is from the ball early in your possession, the more points per possession. So get someone on the ball as opposed to everybody get back and pack the paint, get someone on the ball. Once you get someone on the ball, get someone on the wall, take away the 9, right? That's you know, pretty traditional. And then danger, instead of everyone find your player, we want to find the most dangerous player in transition. And how we address that in the lock left, I'm not even going to talk about our layer 2 and hunting passes, but ball wall danger in transition. And then just take a look at your time on your practice plan. traditionally most coaches spend the majority of their time on defense and how they would guard in the half court and not in transition. It should just be flipped. The majority of your defensive time should be spent on transition defense. Easy way to spend more time on transition defense, emphasize transition offense.
Agreed. This was fun. We got to do some more over-unders.
I know. I've got seven more that we didn't get to, so maybe we'll do a over-under part two.
Yeah, I've got some I didn't get to as well, so maybe that'll do. We'll do another episode on that.
Awesome. Thanks for spending hours with us. We're Savvy Coaching. Until next time.
Stay savvy.